Dream big, never stop dreaming, because you can do whatever that you want as long as you believe in your dreams.
Hi guys, this is Bridget from Dare to Dream Productions podcast. We are live at the Music Box, the historic Music Box, and today I am interviewing Alex Thompson.
Hello.
Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's beautiful out, as you know, and got a little bit of a climb in before I came, which was really nice. Hence the dusty pants. And the festival's been amazing. I just saw Women Talking last night here at the Music Box. And I think that was one of the best theatrical experiences I've had in like recent memory. So it was inspiring.
How so? What stood out to you?
I mean, the film itself is like just organically so moving, but it also uses film language in a way that I feel like we, at least I, rarely see today. Like it is rigorously shot in a way that is not expected and never easy. I feel like it just uses like the full crayon box of like film language to tell the story on screen. It feels like totally classical in the way that it approaches its scenes, but at the same time, it's very, very radical. I was kind of blown away by it. I was sitting with people who were like very, very smart film folks who like immediately started talking about it, and I just felt a little dumbfounded. Just a little starstruck and dumbfounded having like watched it. Highly recommend it. I think it's wonderful. Just wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to check it out. Do you think where is it going to get a theatrical release, or will it?
I think it will. I think early December.
Okay.
So it's coming up. So yeah. Yeah.
Very cool. So I wanted to talk mainly about, you know, you went from St. Francis.
Yes.
Which is like a drama, kind of comedy, and then to directing a horror and psychological thriller.
Yeah.
What was that like, and what made you at the time, you know, make that switch?
Yeah, well, it's funny. It's almost like if you knew me as a kid, St. Francis was in some ways the more surprising movie. Because it's like I wasn't even really aware of like what a dramedy was. Like when I grew up watching like old Hollywood films from like the golden age, so to speak. My grandfather was a Greek immigrant, and he just like loved those movies, and sort of I would go to Blockbuster and get like a stack of 10 Humphrey Bogart movies, and you know, that was like the weekend. But so I was sort of set up for these, I don't know, like kind of fast-paced, character-based thrillers. Those were sort of the things I loved the most, and those are the movies I kind of mimicked when I first picked up a camera, like whatever, age 8 or 9, like just messing around, like finding sound effects on the Windows 97 or 98 computer. So like St. Francis really came about just super organically. I was working on trying to like, you know, push the boulder up a hill of this assassination thriller that still has not been made. Called Jack Be Nimble. And I was like, you know, I just had no clue how to even begin with something like that. I was like, I don't think it was good enough. I think it was big. I had only done 2 very intimate short films at that time. And so with St. Francis, I literally read like the first 9 pages, and it just felt so fresh and so urgent and immediate and funny, and like there was blood and humor and like a propulsive story, and it felt like at the time we were like, we'll make this really fast. Like and it was the easiest movie to raise money for because it was just there, it was on the page. And we're like, we'll make it really fast. And I think some of us were like, God, you know, by the time we finish this story won't even be relevant anymore. Like people will be like, abortion, so what? And it was, it's wild how crazy we've slid downhill from there. But yeah, but weirdly rounding being this like sort of tight, twisty thriller is way more the movie that I think I would have made in like middle school. So it's almost like I went home for the pandemic, you know, got stuck in Kentucky, sitting on the, you know, sitting on the same back porch that I was when I was like 8 or 9 years old or 10 or 11 years old. And I sort of like regressed and like had that old kid brain was like, you should go make a movie. Like you should make a movie and it should have like a monster in it. And it should have blood and twists and turns and you should move the camera in all these ways. And it was an opportunity, I think, to kind of stretch my legs a little more with camera work and film language, sort of in the way that I think, you know, like I've mentioned Women Talking, like the camera really moves and it really has a perspective. And that's so much harder. It's so much easier and nicer to like just say like, okay, my thesis statement for this is get out of the way of the story. Just get out of the way. 40 millimeter lens on the shoulder and just get out of the way. And if we have to move in, we'll move in, but otherwise, stay out of the way. Like, let Kelly's words, Kelly's script, these wonderful actors, let them make the discoveries. And with rounding, it was like, wow, this guy's being chased down the hallway by a monster. Like, I can't really like just let the monster be, I have to do something. So it was definitely like a way of reaching back to like a me that, you know, doesn't get to stretch its legs as much. So it was fun. And then Namir made it possible. Namir Smallwood, who is the lead in the film, knowing Namir is what made me feel like the story was gonna be worth telling. Because I just couldn't imagine anyone else in that role. And so he got like the first 10 pages, I think. Like the first 10 pages. And was on board from there. So, I don't know, that's a long answer.
That's amazing though. Like, I love that reflection. I think the quarantine and just like going back home, mm-hmm. it does something to your psyche. And like, it really, you know, doing inner child work and like, I don't know, it definitely felt, this film felt very like personal. I felt like I got that.
That's cool. That's cool. Cause my brother worked on it. You know, he was a co-screenwriter. It started out with him just like annotating the script because he himself is a resident. And my dad is a pulmonologist. And so they would like read scenes. This was before there was any hope of this movie even being made. It was just like in the dining room, read scenes, make notes like, this is ridiculous. This scene is ridiculous. No doctors would ever say this. And eventually they got more and more invested and it became this like really fun. It was play. It was like really play, you know, where suddenly I think they realized like, if I tell Alex, they call me Alexander, but they're like, if I tell Alexander this story, it might end up in this movie. Like it might actually end up in the movie. And they just got more and more invested. And so it really was personal, like it really was personal trying to make it. My dad was actually on set. He worked with the art department, which was really fun for him. Yeah, I don't think they resented him too much being there. I actually think they really loved it. They gave him like a little gift bag at the end. It was Aww. It was really sweet.
And I was just gonna ask you about that. Like it seemed very authentic, like what the, you know, the doctors, the terminology. Did you do any research or just talk to your dad and brother? Like, what was that process like?
There were four, so this is what's crazy. There were four doctors living in my family's house during the pandemic. Whoa. At one time, there were four doctors. It was my brother, my dad, my brother's friend, Noah, and then our family friend, Justin, who was visiting his mom in town, but he couldn't be in the house. This was pre-vaccine. This was like way pre-vaccine. This was, I guess we wrote the script in like October of 2020. So it was about like 5 months into the proper pandemic shutdown. But it was just them, just running everything by them. In fact, some of the research ends up in the film. There's a scene where Max Lipschitz's character, Carol, says, we'll try harder. And Namir corrects him and he says, we don't try harder, we try something else. And that was something that my brother's friend Justin had said to me reading the script. Some character said, like, we'll try harder next time. And he was like, oh, no, we can't. You don't say we'll try harder, you say, let's try something else. And I thought, wow, that crystallizes what the mentality has to be to like survive in that world. So it became a sort of challenge where it was like, okay, so I'm not particularly well versed in the horror genre. I'm not a huge horror buff. Like my love of horror is like quite surface level. Like, you know, there's a few standouts, but a lot of it's quite old and like a lot of like forgotten thrillers. But I knew that I could make it feel real to some extent, both with the details and with the performances, was the hope that it was like, okay, if I can basically do what I did on St. Francis and like come from an empathetic place, then we'll trust all these performances and we'll trust these characters in a way, which became really important when I started to think about how potentially creepy the main character could seem, fixating on this young woman, or the way that we eventually kind of tried to push it on her case. So the fact that Namir was able to be, to seem genuine and rooted in genuine care was really important, because otherwise I think we would have been telling the wrong story, or like radically. So, yeah, I don't know if that's useful.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah. I love that you mentioned inner child, though, because I do parts work with therapy, like IFS work. So it was cool to hear you pull that out of my ramble. But yeah.
And do you have any advice for an independent film director trying to get their film funded? Like, how did you
do Yeah, that? I would say don't start until you have the script, I would say. Like, really don't. My advice to anybody who's looking to raise money for a film is start raising money when you know that you can start building all the other pieces. When you have a script that actors could read and fall in love with, or at least consider, that's a good time. Because essentially what you want to do is take a pitch deck to everybody that you know and say, hey, I'm doing this. Do you know anybody who might be interested in investing? And what you'll do is you'll get like 9 out of 10 people will be like, no. And then one person might lead you to another person, which will lead you to another 10 people, and so on and so forth. And I really do think, I mean, that's in some ways, that's how St. Francis got financed. It really is about just putting it out into the world, and that you're looking for financing and that you're looking for people to be a part of the process, which is really the way you should frame it. I think you, at this stage, if I'm speaking to like the proverbial independent filmmaker on a first or second feature, should be looking for folks who want to support your vision, but who are also going to be invested in like the life of the film, right? And so, you know, approach folks, make sure that you have the right paperwork, make sure that you know what the deal waterfall looks like, and make sure you have a producer who can touch base with everybody.
So I also saw some familiar faces from, you know, St. Francis in the film. What was your intention behind this, and will all of your films kind of interconnect with characters in some way? Do you have like that?
I would love to continue working with these actors. I think I just like, when you work with an actor more than once, when you work with an actor once, you end the process in like the nervousness of like, A, is this director, do they know what they're doing? Are they gonna make me feel uncomfortable? Are they gonna make me feel vulnerable? Or am I gonna be comfortable? Am I gonna be comfortable being vulnerable? at the end of the process, it's like all those questions are answered, and you kind of have a mutual understanding. And if they've seen the film, it's even better, because then they're like, oh, thank God, it didn't turn out to be total garbage. Like, I talked with an actor who has a really brief, wonderful role in the montage, the opening doctor montage, or hospital montage, David Parks, at the premiere, and he told me afterwards, he was like, Alex, I'll be honest, I got your email and I showed up on time, and as I was coming up the escalator, I saw the Chicago International banner. He was like, I had no idea this was the Chicago International Film Festival. And then I watched the movie, and it was like a real adult movie, like a grown-up movie. And he was like, as an actor, you take on these projects and you say yes to stuff, and you show up on set, you never get to see what it looks like. And so working with folks again just means that everybody comes on set and they have, like, basically the benefit of the doubt. Like, you have the benefit of the doubt, they have the benefit of the doubt. You know, I don't think any part was auditioned in rounding. Every offer, every role was an offer, like, across the board. St. Francis, every role except for one was an offer. And I love that, because what you're doing as a director when you offer an actor a role is you're saying, I trust you. I trust, like, what you're gonna discover. I trust what you're gonna bring. And, like, why wouldn't you want to discover something? I just feel like it's such a fruitless exercise to audition something to death and think, like, all right, I gotta get it in the room the way that it's gonna be on screen. Because, man, wouldn't you rather see it happen live in front of you and then call cut and know that you got this magical thing? So, long story short, I guess, I really love those people as individuals, and so I'd love to keep working with them. It's kind of like, why not? Like, I'm writing a project with Max Lipschitz, who is in both films currently. Kelly O'Sullivan, who obviously wrote and starred in St. Francis and is in Rounding. We're co-directing the next feature that she wrote. Brad Smith, who's in both films, is writing a project that I'm going to produce. So it's really, I don't know, I like fostering the family that you have. And then, like, you know, Namir is a new member of that family, though I've known Namir for a very long time. You know, it's like it's the same crew, or a very similar crew to St. Francis, same cinematographer. I don't know. It's fun to have people grow with you. Yeah, does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. I think that's beautiful. I think that's, like, you know, what a lot of filmmakers strive for, is, like, that community. Once you find your tribe or community,
right,
you want to work with them. You want to cast them, help them out, and you help each other out. Like,
totally.
Love it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I love it. I love that feeling. Tribe's a good word for it. Yeah.
So I read that you were inspired by watching morning films on AMC. And as a young filmmaker, which filmmakers were you inspired by for directing Rounding?
Well, I love Otto Preminger and a lot of his, I guess, more like notable work, Anatomy of a Murder and Bonjour Tristesse, and I love Sidney Lumet. And I was particularly inspired by, actually, Kelly Reichardt's Certain Women. It was something that I, like, revisited over and over again. Just for the way that characters are framed and the way that dialogue scenes were choreographed and built out. It just felt really natural, and she has a real knack for, like, making you feel like you're in a place, a really specific place. So, ironically, that was, like, not a horror film or a thriller, but something that I returned to a lot.
So the film is set during the winter in what seems to be a very small town, and the snow shots really stood out to me. They're beautiful. And him just running up that, like, what is just like a recreation center?
Just massive staircase.
Yeah, massive staircase. And it kind of connects to what he's feeling inside.
Right.
But what was your reasoning for setting it during the winter?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it was the winter when we shot. And so it was this sort of, you could set it in the fall, or you could set it in a different time and sort of shoot around all of real life. Or you can sort of cross your fingers and say, all right, it's winter time. Which meant that it was also holiday time too. So there are some scenes where like one of the nurses is wearing a Santa Claus beard, you know, in one scene. And, you know, there's some Christmas trees and stuff that helps us clock the passage of time as well. And New Year is also a big part of the end of the film. And so I like the winter because of the desolation and the simplicity of it. It really carves the image back to Mimir. You know, a single man running through oblivion, essentially. There are some shots where it essentially just looks like him in a sea of white. And there was something just stark and something sort of that allowed a little bit more intention with those images, allowed them to be a little cleaner. And it just so happened that one of our biggest visual references was the movie Birth, the Jonathan Glazer film, or Grazer film. that film is set at least partially in the winter time. And so some of the images that we borrowed or played with were really easy to conjure and manipulate because of that. Though it was very difficult on the cast and crew. I mean, very, very difficult. Our poor first AC, Alex Hahn, his fingers were bleeding by the end of the first week, which was all exteriors. So all the running shots were done over the course of 5 days, essentially, in Galena, Illinois, where that was shot. So, yeah.
I like how it's, you know, you used Illinois, because I feel like Illinois doesn't, like, it's getting, you know, more representation on screen, but
yeah,
I like that.
Yeah, yeah. We were given a list of small towns, and Nate and I just drove around one day, and we hit all these small towns and college campuses, and when I saw that hill, it was like, well, we've got to, the staircase shot you mentioned, when I saw the staircase from across the train tracks, because we shot that from a playground, like about a mile away, on a zoom lens. And when I saw those stairs, I was like, well, this has got to be the place. I mean, it's so much easier to shoot what exists rather than to try to shoot around what exists. Yeah, it was fun to lean into all that. Yeah, Illinois could be cool.
And I spotted some horror tropes like hallucination scenes. And how did you work with these classic horror tropes but make them kind of your own style?
Well, I like that the question implies that I did make them my own style. That's nice to hear. Do you feel that they were different in some way? Or
yeah, continuous? I think, yeah.
I guess we what did we do? It really, for me, I knew that if I tried to mimic something, it was not going to turn out well. There's a shot where Namir, like, stands up in his chair and then runs off camera. And it's essentially like a Spielberg camera move where, like, the camera pushes in and pans up, and just as it reaches them, they move away. And I think Spielberg really knows why he does that. And I didn't. I just knew that it had like a emotional effect on me. And in recreating it, I remember turning to Nate and being like, I think we got it, but that's really not like us. Like that move was like, it's so muscular and kind of flashy in a way and action movie-esque that this story really isn't. So the moments that did feel like earned were shot with the same lens as all the other more grounded moments were, with the same focal length, you know, the same sort of everything was meant to feel unified and continuous. And so when Namir is dealing with this monster in the basement, or these hallucinations, essentially, it was a basement to us, but I think, you know, it's like, I always thought of it as sort of like an upside down version of the hospital, and something that one wouldn't notice now because we cut a scene outside of the morgue is that it's actually the same hallway that the morgue is in. So it's almost like her death is something that we're linked to from the very beginning, those green walls, and actually I think they're blue now in the new color grade, but those colorful walls. But you know, it was Namir was not bringing any silliness or unmotivated bigness to any of the proceedings. You know, the way, because he was like the key, the linchpin of understanding how terrible the things were that were happening to Sidney Flanagan's character, just as much as he was the linchpin for how we were supposed to understand this seven-headed beast. So if Namir wasn't grounded and believable, then all of these things would be kind of silly and amorphous. But I really think Namir brought the specificity. And those were weirdly moments when I just kind of got out of his way. And he was also very tired. So I think that helped him get to a funky place. But yeah.
I was going to talk about his performance, and I felt like he did a stunning job.
I'm so glad to hear that.
And what was your process working with him? Were there any specific techniques as a director that you did?
I don't know. You know, it's funny. I try to be really open on set, just open to everybody else's process, because all the actors have different processes, and the crew have different processes. And I think sometimes when you model that openness with the crew, A, it's pretty surprising to most people, but it also sort of sets a precedent for the actors that they can have their processes too. They don't need to be protective of their processes. So, you know, for instance, I think prior to Michael Potts arriving on set, it was really just Namir and I for a long time. Namir running, Namir climbing stairs, Namir, and eventually Namir and Max in the apartment. But then words get introduced into the story. You know, I think the very first word that I directed was Namir's line into the phone, discharged. He's like limping down a country road and he gets a cell phone call and he says discharged. And I remember I heard those words and I was like, oh my God, I don't know how to direct words. I've just been directing running. And we did it 13 times and we used the second take ultimately. Because I was just so insecure. I was like, God, I don't think I know how to direct. But when Michael got there, it was really wonderful to see, because Michael was very comfortable saying, I don't want to hear any notes, let's just go again. Like, I know something's not right, let me stay in the zone, I want to go again, let's just go right away. And then I saw Namir start to do that. So Namir saw that Michael created this space for his process. And then Namir started to do the same thing, where he'd just close his eyes and he'd say, let's go again. And it was great, because eventually what happened is we would get through the takes until they felt good and I felt good. And then I would always say at the end of every setup, all right, this is the last take, we're gonna go again, but we have everything that we need. So if there's anything else that you wanna leave on the floor, like, give it now. If there's anything you want to try, you know, essentially anything at all, now's the time. And a lot of times those were the takes that ended up being used, because there was no pressure. We already had it. And they were often the takes that had the most discovery in them. The most like, ooh, You know, where'd that come from? You know, what's happening right now? What am I thinking about? What am I processing in this moment? So that was really fun. Mostly, I think, I've said, because Kelly and I are co-directing, I've had the opportunity to think a lot about directing style. And I think whereas some directors will be the one to pull you into the corner and give you the note that will make you say the line in the way that they want you to, I'm far more likely to be the one to make the space for you to find that on your own and to discover. I'm just so much more interested in discovery. I often say to students, I occasionally teach, that if a line only sounds good or only makes sense with one intonation, it probably isn't a very good line to begin with. Because I feel like directors get stuck on stuff where emphasis on the this or the emphasis on the this, or like say it more like this. And I think some actors love line readings. I just don't know why the focus is on the line. It's so much more than that. You know, the medium is so much more than the words that are being spoken. So I've just never gotten hung up on it. I think because it's probably not my strong suit. But, you know, at least it has the, like, the sheen of freedom and discovery to it, even if it's also masking my insecurities. So.
But I like that word, discovery, and, like, trusting the actor's process and letting them kind of lead in the moment.
Yeah.
I like that.
Well, they're going to come up with stuff that you never thought of. Wouldn't you much rather see the movie when you've been editing it for, you know, 3 or 4 months? Wouldn't you much rather be watching stuff that you've never thought of than the stuff that you already kind of calcified on the page and then, like, kind of chipped off into production and threw onto a one-liner and a call sheet? And then the actor comes along and the production designer and the DP, and they make that little line on the call sheet into something kind of real and beautiful and fresh. And, you know, that's the thing I want to be staring at 4 months down the line, not whatever I wrote in the script, you know, 6 months prior. Yeah.
I think that's a beautiful feeling whenever everything does come together. And yeah, like you said, each person giving like their own kind of ideas and sparks.
Totally, totally.
And so I'm curious about the symbolism and backstory of James's foot injury.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed to be progressively worse throughout the film. Was there any meaning behind it, or was it used for like character development?
That's a good question. I think Christopher and I, my brother and I, thought that we needed James to have a hobby, like something outside of doctoring that we could use to track how he's doing on the inside, because he's such an internal character. And so running was something that our dad always did and still does, and something we do because we're his kids, and saw that, you know, modeled. And so the idea of a doctor running on his off hours made a lot of sense, just to start. And then the injury was in part because we thought, well, what could show that this person is losing, essentially, like, can't be trusted to make the right decision, like pushing through the pain. And then what if this injury is actually far greater in his mind than it is in real life? You know, that essentially it's staying bad because he's not taking care of it. But in his mind, it's like this harbinger of demons. You know, it's like his ankle is this thing that sort of summons these creatures. You know, there's like a trail of blood. You know, he looks back and realizes that he's been dragging a trail of blood like down the hallway, and there at the end is this creature. Or, you know, his ankle snaps and then he falls, and you look at it and it's like, you know, covered in pustules and stuff, and then right behind them pops up this creature. And so we like the idea that when we are feeling weakest, or when we're feeling the most vulnerable, that's when sort of the demons of anxiety, that's when they prey on us, essentially. Like, the big joke of the monster in the film is that it can never hurt James. It itself is sick and pitiful and like reclined on the ground. And it tries to get, you know, if you watch the film again, it's always trying to get up and trying to get after him. But in some ways, like, the monster is his own self-pity and trauma. And he's constantly running away from it. But if he were to turn towards it, as essentially he has to in the film's final moments, he would find that it's him. Like, he's the only thing that's keeping this monstrosity alive. And ironically, we wrote the film far before I had really done research into, you know, my own anxiety, and my own, like, process with that. And far before I'd read Sarah Polley's book, Run Toward the Danger, which is, you know, has a very similar thesis statement, that essentially you kind of have to turn into the stuff that is causing the pain and weighing you down, rather than avoiding those triggers. Yeah, I don't know. But at the same time, it was an easy way to show that James was getting worse, and to sort of have the audience go, this guy is not making the right decisions. So I think it was as simple as that, and you could do a deep dive and, you know, make an argument that it's complicated, but, or complex, whichever one.
That's very interesting. I could definitely see that now that you described it like that.
Well, thanks.
Cool. Okay. And what do you hope the audience takes away from this film overall?
Well, I like that question. I don't know. I like the way it ends, because the words that are being said are optimistic, you know? We all lose our minds a little bit sometimes, I think essentially is what Dr. Harrison says, which is reassuring, you know? It's like, I get it. And then he says, Happy New Year, James, and the Auld Lang Syne plays and the fireworks go. And so it's objectively kind of hopeful, but I hope that there's basically like a complicated feeling where you've heard this hopeful dialogue, it's fireworks, it's celebration, it's singing, there's cake in the conference room, everyone's probably eating it by now, but something's not right and something's not going to work out in this story. Like, James's life is going to be changed forever. And I don't know if it's for the better, but I don't know. I read a shitty Letterboxd review of Rounding, where someone was like trauma and monsters and Christian symbolism, and all I got out of it was people go through it sometimes. And I kind of like, I do think that's kind of what you leave with, is like, we all do kind of go through it sometimes. And it may look like we're functioning on the outside, but on the inside, we might be running from demons that you've never even imagined. So in some ways, I actually think the worst Letterboxd review might be like pretty accurate, in that we do all kind of go through it sometimes. Maybe it's like the same as St. Francis, where at the end of the movie, it's like, we should talk about stuff more. It'd be a lot less lonely. In some ways, it's exactly the same thing, you know? James is constantly bumping into all these characters who say, what's up? Talk to me. Like, literally, sit down and talk to me and tell me what's going on. And he's not really able to do that. But if he was, maybe things would be easier. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that's a really good note to leave on a film, because I think just overall, not even in just America, but mental health is not talked about.
No.
And like now we're starting to, I felt like the pandemic really was a wake-up call that, you know, it's okay to be sad.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it. But now, I don't know where we're headed, where we are now. Like, it's okay, but then like, what are we doing about it?
Mm-hmm.
Like that, what action steps are we like doing? Especially, I don't know if you feel this way, like film can be very, very stressful.
Totally.
And like providing resources even for filmmakers.
Yeah.
And like, I don't know, I've done a podcast with a woman in New York who's doing like trying to get union hours to be less.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
There's an actor who is a fellow Kentuckian, Steve Zahn. When I was a PA on a TV show he was on, I remember he said about the 12-hour day. Our days on that show were like 13, 14 hours. But he was like, someone just decided that it was gonna be miserable. And that's just, and that everyone was just gonna deal with it. And so someone can decide that it's not gonna be miserable, you know? And it's really just like, how much are we willing to take? Do you have to have a family to demand humane hours, you know? Like I remember I was like, you know, 20 years old on set, on 14-hour days, 15-hour days. Sleeping 3 hours a night for months at a time. You know, I think I was entitled to a better life than that. And you're right. It's wild that like if you're on a TV show, do you just not go to therapy? You know, like because I'm on telehealth. Like I do Zoom therapy, but like my therapist can't just reschedule me for the weekends. I don't even think most therapists do weekends. It's like how do you create opportunities for people to feel like they're being taken care of? Because it's never gonna be, I think here's the thing, is it's never gonna be the easiest decision, but it's never going to be as expensive or as hard as anyone says it is. Like, I just did an industrial for a friend of mine. It was really fun to just be an AD for like 3 weeks. We realized like halfway into the first day that the contracts were for 8 hours and not 12 for the actors. And so we just decided, all right, let's do it. Like, let's see if we can do it. And we got out of there in 7.5 hours every day, just because we set our mind to it and we scheduled for it. And that was so, that was awesome. And now rolling into this next film, which is a big, big feature, it's like, well, if I could do that on a $200,000 industrial, why couldn't I do that on a $6 million feature, you know? Where there are theoretically more resources and more people to take care of who deserve respect and consideration. So I think for the magic that happens on set in order for films to be made, they've just got to be as humane as humanly possible. I mean, it's wild. It's such a creative endeavor, and yet it's like deeply capitalist in that it's like, how far can we stretch the human body? Like, how far can we stretch these folks before they say stop? Coming up as a PA, I have a lot of like strong feelings about it. Because you're essentially like when I was doing it, you were like $135 a day player with no job security, huge responsibilities. And I don't know, it was just wild. It was like kind of being, you were very disposable despite all that, you know? It's like you think it was one or the other, either like you're treated really well, but you're disposable, or you're treated really poorly, but you're needed. And this was like, you're desperately needed. You make the trains run on time, and yet there are 35 other people who will take your position, you know, if you don't show up for hour 16 or you know, I don't know. Anyway.
Oh, well, those are some really good points. And, like, I really hope, like, that's a good point, that why are we not, like, changing the hours? And, like, if it's possible to stay within budget, to make it possible, like, and to do it for a feature, like, why not?
Yeah. It's just the matter of saying we're going to do this. It's like representation. It's the same way. Like, sure, it's going to be, maybe it'll be a little bit harder for you to look for a white male director to look outside the mirror and, like, find folks who don't look exactly like them or who weren't their best guy friends in college. Yes, you'll have to send, like, 6 more emails or call 6 more people. But you can do it. Like I believe you can do it. And sometimes it is hard because there have been fewer opportunities for anyone who isn't a straight white man, essentially, in this business. But, you know, I feel like it's just a matter of saying, we're going to do it, you know. We're not considering white men for these crew positions, you know. That's something that I've, you know, that we're having conversations about that right now. It's like, okay, we're just not going to consider people for these crew positions. We're only looking elsewhere. And it's once you make that decision, it's the easiest thing in the world. You just kind of have to commit to it and say, like, we're doing this. Same thing with the hours. It's like someone, probably the line producer, is going to be like, we can't do 8-hour days. We can't do 10-hour days. Someone, it might as well be the director, just has to say, we are. And you do what you can to make it work, and I'll do what I can to make it work. But essentially, someone's just got to say, we're doing this. Because if no one does, it's just going to come down to what's cheapest. And the person deciding what's cheapest, again, is often the very person who's benefiting most from the disparity. So, I don't know. Money. Money's nuts.
Capitalism.
Capitalism. It is. It totally is. Yeah, film is like weirdly the most, it's like the ugliest bastard child of capitalism of all, many, many industries. I mean, there were many worse industries, but it's a pretty nasty one, and it's so obvious. I mean, when you're talking about like an industry where a 15-hour day is normal across the board, that's pretty nasty. That's nasty capitalism. Anyway, sorry.
You're going to change it.
I plan on it. I really am going to try.
Yeah.
Because I've definitely not always been the, like, it's funny, I think, I haven't always been the one who knows what to do and knows how to do it. Like, on St. Francis, we had, like a mission to crew up with a certain number of women and people of color. And the way that we did that ultimately was by working with DePaul and bringing in a lot of interns who were then given these titles and these jobs that were like way beyond the intern status. And so on the one hand, we were totally bringing folks in who were fitting the representational needs of our like mission. On the other hand, they were barely, if not at all, being paid. You know what I mean? And they had huge responsibilities. They had job security. They had like, they got to be a part of this thing. But I think anytime anyone is telling you to do it for the credit, there's like kind of a scam. It's kind of like, at the end of it, it's like, it will always be worth it if the process was respectful and positive. And it's never worth it if it's not. It doesn't matter if you're working on like Killers of the Flower Moon or something, you know, it's like, if it sucks, it's not worth the credit, you know? Mm. So, trying to do better every single time, essentially. Every set, every budget you encounter is gonna be like, it's gonna have a set idea of how that budget or set should work based on the last set and the last budget. And it really, I do think, comes down to often the director or the creative producer saying, I want things to be different. I want to do these things differently. And it's only ever going to matter. Like, it doesn't have to, you don't have to be riding a cultural wave. either. You know, it doesn't have to be something anyone else is doing. But if it's something you're insisting upon, then I think that's, it really does kind of sit with the filmmaker. That it's like that their responsibility ultimately. Because it's about the world that they want to foster and build. And, you know, my AD, or I don't even like to say my, an AD I love to work with, Alex Wilson, was just on a set where I believe it was 8-hour days and there's childcare on set. And I just loved it. And that was like an indie, like a really small movie. And so somebody said, this is important to me. We have to have this. And I don't, it's gonna cost something and we're gonna have to figure it out. But like, I want this. I want this as badly as I want this camera or this lens or this actor, you know, or this location. Like, I want this. So I used to think that you needed money to make a budget. Like when I was a kid, you know, my parents were always like, you should budget. And I'm like, I have no money. Like, how do I budget? And I think it's the same way where when you're an independent director, you think that you are the underdog. And you think that you don't have power. But you do have power within the context of your project. And so in fact, you are the absolute arbiter of like whatever is gonna change. Changes in the microcosm of that, whatever, that little tiny thing that you're doing. And so the choices you make there end up resonating. And I'm learning that, like every single project, I'm learning that kind of fresh.
And last question, we talked a little bit about inner child, and mm-hmm. I always ask this when I do interviews. What would you tell your younger self if you could talk to him? Hello.
I would say, what would I tell? Well, I do talk to my inner child. You know, I do talk to my inner child. I think, I don't know that I would have anything to say to them. I think they would be the ones telling me, like reminding me, like, this is cool. Like, you're doing it. Like, you're a director. You always wanted that, right? I think that that's sort of the most beautiful thing that your inner child can offer, is the reminder that, like, you're doing the thing that you always wanted to. And that's enough, you know. That's enough. That's, you didn't have to win an Oscar when you were 10 to have fun making movies. So why not have fun now as well? So I think that's what I'd say. Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about? Or
I think it's so cool. I want to see your doc. When it's done, when you're like looking for feedback, when you're in the edit, like I really want to see that doc.
Thank you. That really means a lot.
Yeah. Did we talk about that on camera or on mic, or was that off mic?
It was off mic.
Oh, okay. But I don't mean to blow it up, but
people know about it.
Okay, cool, cool. Yeah. I want to see the skate park talk. Yeah.
Thank you. Well, this has been such a lovely discussion. Thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for watching the film. Thanks for, you know, thinking so hard about it. It's really like why I make movies, is to have other people talk about it. So it's amazing. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for watching Dare to Dream Productions podcast. We'll see you next time.